Before getting into the episode that follows, I want to provide an update that came from the most recent Landmine Monitor report. It concluded that Myanmar has recorded the largest number of annual casualties from landmines for the first time in its reporting. As the country marks this grim milestone, Insight Myanmar is producing a monthly series, Navigating a Minefield, centering on the people at greatest risk as well as survivors of traumatic attacks. The series will feature Burmese and international experts providing important context about landmine use and explosive remnants of war endangering communities across the country. In cooperation with our media and humanitarian partners, we hope that this vital information will support risk education, raise awareness, and inspire action based on our shared responsibility to end this terrible threat to civilians. More about the episodes, as well as risk education resources, are available on the Insight Myanmar website. For now, let's get into the episode that follows. Thank you for sitting down with us for a second time here at Inside Myanmar Podcast.
My pleasure.
We are speaking to you about your recent book, Narcotopia. We spoke to you a bit before. We encourage listeners to go and check out that interview. But this time we'll be talking about your in-depth research into with Narcotopia that looked into the Wa people and the Wa army and several decades of involvement, as well as recent updates. I think a great way to start this conversation off and to get us behind the curtains of what this book is actually about is the title itself. So maybe you can break down how you chose this title and what it means to the story that you're telling.
Yeah, sure. Narcotopia. Not a real word, a word I made up. look, honestly, I thought it was catchy. But if you want to look at the deeper meaning behind it, the Greek suffix topia is something any word you attach to the beginning of that tells you the nature of that place. So a utopia is a wonderful, wonderful place. A dystopia is a horrible, horrible place. I wasn't meaning to suggest that, Wa State was utopian or dystopian, only that not just Wa State, but in the entire environs of Shan State have been so drastically affected by the narcotics trade. It's just a key pillar of the economy for some people good and for many people really quite bad. I think another way that I look at it is, Saudi Arabia is a petro state, and that's why I call Wa State a narco state. It just means that the economy, the way of life, the financial underpinnings of that area to a large degree, not entirely, but to a large degree have involved illegal narcotics. And the book is full of stories of people fighting that, people who benefited from that. And it's just a facet of the region that I think is undeniable.
Yeah, and I think that's a great breakdown of where you go in the book and also a segue from our last conversation where some of these same themes and ideas were brought up there, but certainly expanded on more here. And before we get into going into the particulars of Wa State and some of the characters and history that you bring in, I think it may be advantageous to have a bit of Myanmar 101 for some listeners, because I think that, or if not Myanmar 101, then looking at the Myanmar nation state 101, because I think one of the things that comes as a surprise for those that haven't really followed Myanmar's recent history in last several centuries is this phenomenon that the current borders of the Myanmar nation state, that at no time in history has any central authority ever laid claim to actually controlling them. And that's something that can be a bit hard to wrap your head around. And Wa State is not the only example of this. There are others. But if I'd like to prompt you to talk about just those peculiarities of when we look at Myanmar, that where there are areas in Myanmar, Wa State, in addition to others, that the central government, or whatever you want to call the central authority, does not control now and has never historically controlled.
Yeah, I think, you know, we learn in grade school that here's a country, here's the map, and there's a government, and they control everything inside those borders. In Myanmar, that is just so, so not true. I mean, the borders of Myanmar were that exist today were left behind by the British Empire. It's not that the British went in and really carefully calculated, oh, what if we lump these people in? I'm sure they'll get along with everyone. Oh, I'm sure they want to be a part of this nation-building project. They just lumped in as much territory as they could. With the Wa people live on the farthest fringes of Myanmar, then called Burma, in the mountains. These are really rugged mountains. People are growing rice and corn on slopes. They would love to have some nice flat land to grow some rice and food, but they can't. It's a really aggressive landscape. And the Wa have controlled it more or less since recorded history. This influences the ideology of most Wa people, especially the Wa people I talk to. Yes, they'll say we're part of Myanmar. It's just something that you say. But deep down, they consider their territory theirs. That's non-negotiable. What's happening down in the lowlands of Burma, that would use the word lowlanders, is not necessarily their concern. It even influences what's happening now with the Revolutionary War. That is, to a large degree, considered something that people in the lowlands need to figure out. And the Wa will stick around to see the outcome. Not that the Wa haven't had a role in the current war, and we can talk about that later if you want, but that's the general point of view. It's their land, and I think, controversially, I consider it a country. And I know that's controversial, but that's my point of view.
Right. So your book largely starts out by telling a post-war history. And this is when there was a lot of intrigue with the Chinese Civil War and with CIA involvement, DEA. We'll get into that in a moment. But just to give a prelude to where we get to that point, you mentioned how there was the British were largely responsible for lumping a bunch of territories into something together and then calling it something else. And then after an independence, then those boundaries were that they had put together, then went to Rangoon at the time, where the Burmese independent government was. But I think it would be helpful to look at where the Wa first came into some kind of consciousness. You mentioned that since time immemorial, this is the Wa have been living here. Certainly we know that there was some British colonial contact with them. What was the nature of that? And was there, before the British arrived on the scene, what, if any, understanding do we have of the Wa in this region?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned in the early pages of the book that the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama mentioned the Wa in passing in one of his volumes. Now, he never went there, but he heard about them and he heard that they were cannibals. It's a great way to start thinking about the Wa because it was a rumor and it was negative and it wasn't true. Mm-hmm. And that really helps you understand what most people think of the Wa, I think even today, as a harsh people that live up in the mountains and do whatever they want. And I mean, frankly, it's a racist view. Mm-hmm. I think there are many, many people, even people that I like, will tend to have a dark racist view towards Wa people. When the British were drawing those boundaries, actually it's about the time that they were leaving and went to leave behind a nation state called Burma, there was a lot of hand-wringing over how to include the Wa. And because they knew that it was only on paper. You go up into those mountains, and it's not a small region, by the way, that there were all these Wa villages, fortified villages with wooden barricades, like wooden walls around their fortifications. And the thing that you learn first about the Wa is that at that time they practiced headhunting, and they had practiced it for many centuries before. And that was literally the practice of cutting off rivals' heads, posting skulls, like a number of skulls, a ways away from your village so that as people were approaching it, they would see that and say, maybe not. Mm-hmm. It was a way of maintaining their independence through shock and awe. And as I always like to point out, look, French revolutionaries cut people's heads off. Scottish Highlanders probably in my bloodline cut people's heads off. So they didn't invent this practice.
Yeah.
So this is what was mostly known about the Wa. And they're a really egalitarian people that even then didn't live under one great king or anything like that. But there were some powerful men, you can call them chiefs if you want, that were summoned by the incoming Burmese government as the British are leaving. And they basically said, damn, don't you want schools and hospitals? Don't you want to be a part of this nation-building project? And they said, no, we want to keep things the way that they are. And to a degree, you can feel that ideological underpinning in how many Wa people see things today. So, long story short, the British left. Burma, the colony, became Burma, the nation state, and the Wa were just roped in, and it made no sense. And where things start to get tricky is when the fairly inept Burmese government, soon to be a military government by the early 60s, just worried that the Wa would be a portal through which Chinese communists would come in. And they had reason to worry about that because the Chinese communists were interested in the Wa. And at the same time, the CIA was interested in the Wa because this was sort of a contested space. And it was thought that whoever could co-opt these hardy headhunting warriors would have a huge advantage on their side, and it would be good to bring them under your control, no matter which side you're on. Bringing the Wa under your control has never been easy, and it didn't go as planned for anyone.
Mm. So then that's a great setup for then being able to go in more into the particulars of your book. And here we get introduced to one of your protagonists, which is Sa Lu. So he is a great vehicle to begin this exploration of the context that you said and to understand exactly who he was and through by which means you were able to come in contact with him.
Sa Lu, I mean, I've been a reporter for 2 decades. He's probably the most interesting person I've ever met. He was a warrior. You could call him a warlord. He was a Baptist, a militant Baptist. He was a Wa man who saw things differently than most of his compatriots. And we'll get into his activities with the United States probably later, but just pick it up from the beginning. This is a man who was born in the mid-40s. Unlike most Wa, he was raised in this missionary sect, American missionaries who had gone over there and established a foothold sort of in the environs of Wa land, and co-opted not just Wa, but another indigenous group, the Lahu, with this fierce militant baptism. And there was a small pocket of Wa people who believed these American missionaries were truly sent by God, that they had been sent to convert the Wa, to end their heathenous ways, and that, you know, the, you know, sun shined out of their butt, basically. So Sa Lu grew up in that environment. Through his missionary connections, he later washes into lowland Burma, where they have schools and where they have opportunities. He's a young man, getting an education, learning fluent Burmese at this point. So at this point, he speaks Wa and now Burmese. And Burmese intelligence, they were looking for a guy like him. Thought he was sort of a bit of a godsend, I think, because he was a Wa young man who wanted to, I'm using his words, civilize his people. And they thought, I think as an experiment, let's send this kid, 21, 22, can't remember exactly how old he was, back to where he's really from, you know, the Wah Highlands, but the really difficult to tame Wah Highlands, and he will civilize them. And in doing so, he'll go to the Wah and finally complete this task, which is like, just bring the Wah into the fold, be a part of Burma. I know they're going to be way up in the mountains, but we'll just have them participating. And so most people would have turned this down. He was an outsider to the headhunting part of Wah State, but he went there. He dragged his young wife there. He specifically had targeted this one very large settlement with hundreds and hundreds of people and big wooden walls around it. It's called Pangwai. And he walked past the skulls that were meant to scare him away and introduced himself, and they actually let him in. He was posing as a teacher, teaching them Burmese, and they were much warmer to him, I think, than he even thought. Just as an aside, all the Wa people that I've met and befriended in the course of writing this book have all been extremely gracious, warm people. I want to go, like, shake Vasco da Gama and be like, hey, these people are all right, man. Yeah. But Salu found the same thing. But his real covert mission there was to co-opt them into becoming part of the Burmese nation-building project. He realized that just culturally, the people he was around, they respected strength. And so he was posing as a teacher. They didn't really respect him because he had no like raw power. There was a lucky break he had where... And this is pretty well documented. The CIA had dropped a lot of weapons around that area decades before. Not all of the, I'm talking airdrops with crates filled with weapons, automatic weapons. And they had fallen around that area, and he became aware of this and was able to, very industrious guy, get the locals to tell him whereabout they dropped. And so he had a dozen or so weapons on his side. And in that was the beginning of him forming his own militia up there. It is to his great, and this would have failed with 99 out of 100 people. It is great credit to his charisma, which I fell under as well, that he was able to go from random Wa guy that showed up out of nowhere to be a teacher to a militia leader. And what he did is he tapped into their very legitimate fear that Chinese Maoists were going to come over and try to co-opt their village, which was true. Mm-hmm. Once he had his little startup militia, he didn't have any ammunition, and so the Burmese state started supplying him with that, and then with more and more weapons and some very light training and uniforms, and he formed a militia and became sort of a local warlord. So that was that's Saw Lu's early life.
Mm. So when you mentioned that Salu had this desire to want to civilize his people, civilize the Wa. That civilize in quotes can mean any number of different things. And in the case of Salu, we also, you mentioned his Christian background. So, you know, one thinks about the role that might be playing in it, which interesting that he got connected with the Buddhist Burmese state that would have very different aims. But from what you understood of Salu's mission and his own ideology at that time, what did bringing civilization mean to him in the context of the Wa territories?
First and foremost, being literate. He put a high value on being literate, being able to read and write. Didn't matter the language, you needed to be able to read and write. This is also core to a lot of Christianized groups in Myanmar, where that's sort of the opening act, because they need to learn how to read the Bible in their whatever language. Literacy. Look, he had a lot of negative comments about his own people's like hygiene and bathing habits. And ultimately, he would like to have them accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. Because he's a savvy guy, he saved that sort of for later. That wasn't his opening gambit. But teaching them to read, yeah, that was really key to it. And then to become a unified people. So... because, and you see this with a lot of mountain cultures, because the mountains were so rugged and it takes, you know, days to walk to the next village and then more days to walk to the next village, you didn't have this one cohesive group. I mean, this settlement might have beef with this settlement and might be allied with this one. It was just kind of a constellation of very complex drama happening up in Wa State. And he said, no, we're Wa people. We need to stand together as one, a unified people. And I don't think Saw Lu had any deep love for the Burmese state, but it was they were the one that bankrolled and assisted him in going up to civilize them, which means everything that I just explained.
So one confusing thing here I'm thinking as I hear this is that you have the Burmese state at this time wanting, which in this case is the military, wanting to prevent Chinese Maoists at the border and seeing Sa Lu as an agent they can use, a covert agent they can use to prevent, to kind of buffer this Chinese Maoist aggression. And yet later in the story, we then have the CIA coming in and virtually doing the same thing. But then as we know our history, Burmese history in the 50s and 60s, as it plays out, there then became this huge debacle with the CIA pouring more and more money into supporting, fighting against the Chinese Maoists. In some cases, the, some divisions between what the CIA was doing and the U.S. Embassy in Rangoon, some real tension there, and saying the embassy saying you guys are destabilizing the whole country and you're affecting Burmese U.S. relations and everything else. And the embassy itself couldn't get a handle, let alone proper information on what the CIA was doing. And then that developed into whole things in later years that we can get into with the KMT and the evacuations to Taiwan and everything else. But so I guess the confusing part here is that, hearing the story that came later, one would think, so the CIA and American foreign policy has basically more or less the same approach to wanting to limit the Chinese Maoist incursions into Myanmar as the Burmese military, the Burmese state. So yeah, they're kind of, why wouldn't they just work together? Why would they be at crossroads when it seems like they basically have the same aim? But as you know, Burma's a lot messier than that. So
I can clear up that confusion easily. The Burmese state just had so little influence over that whole mountainous region that the Wa inhabited. If they, as a sign of their desperation, they picked a guy in his early 20s named Saw Lu to go pose as a teacher and maybe pick around the edges of, hey, you guys want to play nice with the Burmese? I mean, this was a pretty crap strategy, frankly. Yeah. Saw Lu made the most of it and kind of ran with it, but that just shows you how desperate they were. They didn't really know what they were doing. Just rank incompetence and also the difficulty of trying to influence people up in these high mountains that are really far away from lowland Burma. So why wouldn't the CIA team up with the Burmese? Well, in this particular project, the teaming up with the Burmese would have given you very little benefit. The mission of the CIA, and I should say a lot of the grunt work was done by the CIA's junior partner, which was the Taiwanese. What they were really focused on is all of these anti-communists pouring out of China because they'd lost the Chinese Civil War, with the Maoists at their heels. And so all of these Chinese, guys with guns and on horseback are rolling into not just Wa State, but Shan State writ large.
Yeah.
And, the CIA was trying to build, that's where the guns, dropping the guns came from. The CIA is trying to build them up into a fighting force so that they can, and they really believe this, go back and win the country back. We're talking about several thousand guys with horses and guns up against the massive Maoist machine that had just won control of China. Mm-hmm. And so all this stuff is just happening around the Wa Mountains. And so when it became very clear that these anti-communist Chinese, often called the Kuomintang, but when I met people connected to that world, they said, don't call us that. Anyway, they would call themselves Chinese exiles. When it became very clear that they weren't going to go back into China and win the country back, you start to see all these other kind of desperate moves from the CIA in Taiwan. And it's like, can we co-opt the Hua to fight the Maoist? Or what can we do? And so all of that is happening around the time that Saw Lu is becoming a young warlord in the Hua Peaks. And there were other warlords around as well.
Yeah, so this is where we start to get into this legitimately messy situation of the Maoists that are, there's some fear of them coming and crossing the border and spreading the revolution, of these many Chinese exiles, the men with guns on horseback that there's some thought about a futile mission that they can go and retake China. When that doesn't happen, well, then now you have the issue of several thousand Chinese exiles causing any number of problems up in the northern hinterlands of Myanmar. You have the growing Burmese military state that's taking hold as well. And then you have the covert CIA activity that's also happening, probably a lot more in those years as well that we're leaving out, just to give some sense of the messiness. And then you have Saw Lu in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
And so, which is why you make him a protagonist in your book, because through his story, we learn about these greater geopolitical and geostrategic aims that are happening through the way that he's being used, and then we can say the way that he's using his growing influence from these other partners. So let's carry on with Salu's story within this messy context that we've now set.
So another thing that Saw Lu, being the good Christian warrior that he was, didn't care for much was opium. Opium is something that the Hua had traded for quite some time. The Hua Mountains is really a bountiful place to grow opium, grow the opium poppy, I should say. For whatever reasons, the soil is very alkaline. The poppies that grow there are very potent. The more potent the poppy, the more efficient your operation is. So all around those Hua Peaks, they grew a lot of opium and they sold it. Didn't so much smoke it, but they sold it. And so what happened was, Saw Lu becomes sort of a warlord in Pang Wai. You have these other Hua warlords that were mainly focused on growing opium poppies. And they interfaced with the anti-communist Chinese that had washed into Burma, who had wisely realized that the CIA was wrong. They were never going to go back and conquer China. And so they maintained the guise as anti-communist freedom fighters, but mostly switched over to industrializing the opium supply in northern Burma. They were incredibly good at it too. Quite a few among them had been opium traders in southwestern China before, so they really knew what they were doing. Hey, one of the reasons that you get kicked out of Maoist China is because you're a landowner, a business owner, a merchant, mm-hmm. and so this group was well suited to know how to build an opium trafficking powerhouse. And so that's essentially what they did. They set up shop on the Thai-Burma border, still doing their mild incursions up to the Chinese border to do their freedom fighting stuff, but mostly focused on sort of lording over the opium supply. A lot of it they got from Shan peasants, sometimes through forcible means, but these Hua warlords, they had a lot of opium and they start selling their supply to these Chinese exiles. And so that's how that all clicked together. At the same time, the CIA is seeing that, oh, wow, so one of our assets, these opium and heroin producing exiles, have now a cozy business relationship with these Hua warlords right on the border with China. And so you start seeing the CIA, again, I want to give Taiwanese intelligence agents a lot of credit because they really did the grunt work. They already speak Chinese, which is a sort of lingua franca in that area. They go in and they start asking these Hua warlords, of which Saw Lu was a member of them, can we put listening stations along your border? Is anybody interested in doing little raids or incursions into communist China to spy, gather documents, tap phone lines? And they found among these Hua warlords people who were ready to accept those tasks. And so you have these warlord guys and their little crews sending people across the Chinese border to wreak havoc. One story I was told involved like blowing up a bridge to create a diversion to go kidnap this guy and get his files and all this stuff. So I don't know how much of these become big fish stories over time, but I think that they were a major nuisance along that Chinese border. Sa Lu is seeing this as an opportunity to have sort of a common cause among all the other Hua. Oh, okay. So now you are pivoted against the Chinese communist. That's exactly what I want. Communism is an enemy of Christianity. And so now we have this common cause. Yes, we're anti-communist. We're Hua. We're all cohesive. And so the CIA and Taiwanese intelligence agents coming in to kind of stitch some of this together worked in his favor as well.
So then in this case, Sa Lu is becoming a double agent. Is that correct?
I would say that Sa Lu has his own agenda, the civilizing and the unification of the Hua people, hopefully under the grace of God, and everything else is just a means to that end. He still kept in very close contact with the Burmese state, but because he was doing something they wanted anyway, keeping Chinese communists from coming into Burma, I think that they just let him do his thing.
That's interesting, though, because while he was keeping Chinese communists from coming into Burma, he was also having access to a lot of guns and gaining influence with these anti-communists that were that were certainly armed and certainly a force to be reckoned with. And then you have the growing opium trade, which is, as you mentioned, is not something he's very fond of, but is something that is starting to kick off with CIA involvement. And so I don't know how much the Burmese state would have known about this at the time, but it seems like some of those things would have been somewhat at cross purposes.
Yes. The other warlords under Sa Lu's direction did sign an agreement to be auxiliary units of Burma's military. So they were playing ball with the Burmese as well. In effect, the Burmese junta got what it wanted because they sent this kid up there. And then, you know, a short time later, all of the warlords who were already fairly well armed said, okay, yes, we will uphold this as Burmese territory. And is you send some weapons and things like that. They were more the double agents because, yes, they were continuing to do business with these CIA-backed Chinese exiles as well. I mean, they just, whatever was in their best self-interest, they would go along with. So I think it's still useful to think of them as warlords who mostly did what they wanted. Burmese state, sure, if you can provide some weapons now and again, that's great. We certainly don't want to be communist. Opium-producing exiles, they're buying weapons from them too as well. In fact, oftentimes trading bundles of opium for automatic weapons, American-made automatic weapons that the Chinese anti-communist exiles had access to. So I think their general idea is they just wanted to keep their opium growing going, and they wanted to keep it not communist because, this is a really important point to make, the Maoist hated opium. And you can read books about the Opium Wars to understand why. But they really considered it a vice that would weaken the communist ideology. So these guys know that if the communists do come over and take over their territory, all the opium is getting burned to the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's not in their interest.
But paradoxically, Sa Lu also detested opium.
he would have liked that, but he, and his order of priorities, he was willing to accept the opium as something that he could tolerate for a while. And their heathenism, as he saw it, too. You know, people close to him did start converting to Christianity, but he didn't make the hard sell for everybody to accept Jesus Christ. I mean, he was trying to work his way there. Unification of the Hua people, I mean, I think he saw that as a first order priority to get anything done.
Right. So just taking a slight detour before we get back on the history of the Hua, as the American covert activity is starting to support this growing activity, which involves opium, we then have to look at the ensuing war on drugs and to ask if there's a connection there, if some of this, the narcotics that are coming out of law state, where that ends up and if we start to see that going through some American lines as well.
Yeah, War on Drugs kicks off in 1973, and this is all very interrelated. What's happening is, as we get into the late 60s here, opium farmed on some hillside in Wa State is being sold to a CIA-backed anti-communist, let's call them a militia, based on the Thai-Burma border. They're opening a lot of heroin refineries, making very pure heroin, and some of that is going to supply the appetite for drugs in South Vietnam, where the United States is trying to beat back communism there. I poured through CIA documents that have been declassified. You can really find a lot of interesting stuff if you dig deep enough. That are basically saying we're seeing a lot of new heroin refineries go up around that Thai-Burma border where their CIA-backed Chinese exiles had control. We're seeing a lot of heroin refineries go up for the purpose of supplying U.S. soldiers in South Vietnam. If you're wondering how a bunch of American soldiers could warp the market for drugs, boy, did they ever, because they had an allowance, a stipend, they had a little cash in their pocket. It wasn't much by American standards, but it was something. And they could actually afford to buy heroin. They were also extremely traumatized, so they had an incentive to want to get high. This is just, at the time, you know, most people in Southeast Asia live on a farm. They don't have cash anywhere in the house, maybe a little to buy sugar and salt or something. They can't support a drug habit. All these Americans with stipends in South Vietnam could. So you're seeing a pipeline that actually leads to opium grown by the Hoa ending up in South Vietnam. I think if you ask the typical Hoa poppy farmer to explain all this back then, they would have no idea what you were talking about. And they would have a very dim idea of what was happening in Vietnam or what America really was.
Yeah.
But that's how it was going. That's how it was playing out.
Right. So then if we could take a wider perspective, and obviously it's probably a case where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, can we say that that in order American foreign policy was looking at, or at least covert action was looking at, in order to prevent the possible spread of communism in northern Burma, they were funding a drug trade, which was then going to Vietnam to weaken the American response to communism and contribute to losing that war in Vietnam?
I think that's one way to put it. This is, when you start looking into CIA activities, the first thing you learn is they're very, very bad at predicting the consequences of their actions. The CIA, first and foremost, exists to promote and strengthen American influence and power around the globe. And whatever its pet causes at the time, this time we're in the middle of the Cold War, genuinely terrified of communism and would do anything to stop it. That is priority number one. If you have to get involved with a opium trafficking militia, then you do. And actually, it's kind of convenient because they traffic opium and you don't have to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars to prop them up. They can do it themselves. If they can kind of hold down the fort in this part of the globe, if you imagine a giant game of Risk, and this part is secure because there's an opium trafficking and heroin trafficking militia there holding down the fort, good. Then you have all these second order consequences where, well, those drugs go somewhere and then they end up in the veins of American soldiers. And I don't know how CIA officers at the time felt about it, or if they felt embarrassed by this, or they just thought it was the...
Do you think they knew? Were they tracking that?
I think you can read these documents that show that absolutely they knew. Mm-hmm. And this spawned a monster, because when we think of the war on drugs, one of the first things we start thinking about is drugs coming from Latin America. But actually, the real impetus for the war on drugs was GIs coming back home to the United States after serving in Vietnam, who either talked about or still suffering from drug addiction to heroin. And you start seeing articles and newspapers around the country pop up, and this organic demand that the American public had. I was like, what the hell happened over there?
Mm-hmm.
I thought we were fighting communists. And, you know, my son or my brother or my dad has come home with this this drug problem. You better do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the dawn of the war on drugs, it was a very awkward situation because the public didn't fully understand that, well, some of those drugs that made their way into your brother or uncle's arm came through a pipeline that was supported in some way by the Central Intelligence Agency. And so there was a directive to clean that up. In fact, as the DEA is created, this is under Nixon, to, okay, heard you loud and clear, American public, we're going to go around the world and we're going to stop these criminal enterprises from spreading drugs that could end up in America. They go in and they look under the covers and they say, whoa. You see in the just before the DEA is going to be formed, there are other agencies that would later become the DEA, but this push has started early 70s. And they go to Thailand and they cut a deal with these Chinese exiles, and they say, you got to hand over all the opium in your warehouses and we'll pay you $1 million, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the book, as compensation for this opium. And then that's it, you're out. And what you can be is an anti-communist force minding the Thai-Burma border, which is what you were supposed to be doing in the first place. And so trucks of opium are brought to a Thai military base in northern Thailand and dumped jet fuel on them and they burned them. And that was supposed to be it.
Mm.
We're out. Mm. Fresh start. And it didn't work. The opium trafficking exiles start right up again next poppy growing season and continue their work. And so it created quite an uncomfortable situation at the beginning of the war on drugs.
So just to clarify, are you saying that the DEA paid the opium growers, which were largely these anti-communist fighters, that the DEA paid them to burn the opium that the CIA was paying them to grow?
Well, it wasn't the DEA. It was a precursor agency called the BNDD, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a prototype DEA agency. Yeah, look, I want to be clear here. The CIA, there wasn't like a CIA officer hanging out in the headquarters of the exiles' territory saying, good job, boys, with that shipment. I mean, what the CIA was getting from them was intelligence. What's going on around that border? Can you send some guys up to the border of China and see what's going on and let us know? And then when it came to their opium and heroin producing enterprise, it was kind of hands off.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go back and see articles where a opium trafficker gets caught and gets caught by American law enforcement. And he says, hey, I'm with those guys and they're in good with the CIA, so you have to let me go. And then the guy gets let go.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the CIA was thrilled that that's how they supported themselves, but they didn't want to upturn the apple cart and have all that intelligence go away.
But one can make the argument that burning their whole cash crop is upturning the apple cart. So,
well, there's always more. There was more where that came from, and they got paid.
Yeah,
they got paid $1 million. This is $1 million in the early 70s. It was, look, I don't remember the cost per kilo of opium in 1971 or whatever, but it was fair compensation, and it was money that American taxpayers paid to the IRS going to them. And they didn't honor the deal, and I think they thought they were above it all because they had these connections to U.S. intelligence, and they did. You know, eventually those Chinese exiles, they kind of withered just because the leadership got old, and they were new up-and-comers, and they were kind of pushed out of the business by a rival drug army led by Khun Sa. And that's a whole rabbit hole. I don't know if you want to go down, but they sort of died from old age, you might say. So there's no moment where the CIA comes in and says, "Party's over, boys."
Yeah.
They wanted to keep that flow of intelligence going. And I don't know how valuable the intelligence was. I mean, I think they would make the case that, listen, fighting communism is more important than drugs, mm-hmm. and so this is a compromise that is worth making.
And that's the tension that you go on to set up in your book, this DEA-CIA tension from the American side. Of course, there's tensions from the Burmese and the Hua and even the Chinese side as well. But on the American side, this the sense of priorities. And if you're coming from the CIA, then you're willing to tolerate, maybe even tacitly support the opium and heroin production because you're seeing that as maybe not a means to an end, maybe something like that, but also an inconvenient truth that has to be reconciled with as you have these further aims that you're trying to accomplish. Whereas if you're coming from DEA, those ends are flipped, and you're just seeing that there is a war on drugs, and we need to use whatever politics aside, whatever you want to call politics, whatever you want to call foreign relations or the international scene. We just our number one role is to eliminate, to find a way to encourage the elimination of these narcotics. And so then you're painting a picture of the direct opposition that some of these groups and individuals would come in as far as it came to American foreign policy.
I talked to a lot of DEA, former DEA agents in the course of writing this book, and then even before this, working on organized crime stories. They have a simpler mandate. And it's, as you said, it's stop drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to have more of a good versus evil, black and white mentality. If so-and-so is involved in drugs, they belong in prison. And that's kind of it. Oh, but so-and-so is a great intelligence asset and is keeping this part of the world from becoming a communist mm-hmm. or a Islamic terrorist or whatever the flavor du jour of the CIA is. A DEA officer would say, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
They're a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
DEA agents believe that when they confiscate a big, gigantic shipment, that they're saving X number of lives. So it's kind of a utilitarian argument. I take 50 kilos of heroin off the streets. I've saved some uncountable number of lives, people that would either ruin their life or actually mm-hmm. die in OD from those drugs. And so it's a very simplistic moral argument. The CIA is a really complicated worldview. As a former station chief of CIA station chief of Burma explained to me, he's like, look, it's a cultural shift. He's like, I don't dislike the DEA, but he said, they lock up bad guys and sometimes we work with bad guys.
Mm.
And he also said, we break laws. He's like, not American laws, but we break foreign laws, for that ultimate cause is to make the United States a more powerful and influential country on planet Earth. So you see these clashes. I do want to make clear that it's not that people shouldn't say, oh, there's a drug trafficking cartel out here. I bet they're backed by the CIA. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, that's not going to
yeah.
be true.
Yeah.
It's only when that cartel might control some territory, they might have influence, they might have really, really good information, that the CIA would say, well, we work with a lot of scumbags, and these scumbags can help us out, so maybe don't arrest them just yet. That's kind of the calculus.
Although it can also be just as morally compromised from the simplistic good versus evil DEA side of it, because then as time goes on, you can there could be a rationale that these individuals that are helping to stop the drug flow, well they're good individuals we should work with. Well, what if those individuals that are stopping certain access to drugs, opium, heroin, what if they are also committing human rights violations? What if they're also oppressing their own people? What if they are also stopping democracy? And they can make that same morally compromised argument. Well, sometimes you have to side with bad guys in order to get the objective that you want. And so, and that's where you get to the messiness of Burma again.
Look, everybody has a boss, okay? And DEA agents are no exception. And their career is measured on seizures. If you're a If you're a field agent, if you're an analyst, it's measured on, you know, how much intelligence you are able to gather and process about this particular group. And they're trying to impress their boss. And so I think it's true of almost everybody. Whatever benefits you, your career, your prestige, your status, you will find a way to make whatever you're doing seem moral. I mean, I think humans are just incredibly adaptable, complicated creatures that no matter what they're doing, can be like, well, you know, I know that that's not so great, but I have to do it, and it's for a greater good. Mm-hmm. And that goes all the way from drug traffickers to human traffickers to warlords. I mean, everyone thinks they're the good guy. Mm-hmm. That's one of my biggest takeaways from reporting on this stuff for more than a decade. Mm.
So then as we start to shift over to back to the Burmese side,
yep.
And to pick up on the trail which you left off, and then we'll bring Salu and some of the other Wa characters into it, you mentioned how these anti-communist Chinese, thousands of Chinese with that were armed, that were now on the southern side of their border and were not looking to go back anytime soon, how they start to age out, combination of them aging out and Khun Sa coming on the scene. So then pick off of who Khun Sa was and then where he starts to fit into what's happening in Wa State.
Yeah. Khun Sa is probably the most well-known, notorious drug lord of Southeast Asia ever. He formerly was involved with the anti-communist Chinese exiles group, but he's such a hothead and such an egomaniac, he splits off. He brings on board as the brains of his operation a younger man at the time named Wei Sikang. Mm-hmm. Wei Sikang is a half Wa, half Chinese young man at the time who actually got his start working in one of those listening posts in Wa country along the Chinese border. From what I was able to gather, and I talked to multiple people who knew him at various parts of his life, he was, I think, receiving radio transmissions, possibly via Morse code, and then translating that into something that the Taiwanese could have as an intelligence product or a file, and then that might have gone to the CIA from there. So this is kind of a whiz kid. Khun Sa scoops him up, makes him the brains of his operation, and this guy Wei, from my telling, is really the cerebral backing to the narcotics business that Khun Sa is running, and it really takes off. You start seeing a lot of heroin going from the jungles of Burma to the United States. I think at one point we're talking about on the order of about half the heroin that's washing into the United States is coming from Burma, a lot of it from Khun Sa. And he becomes, to quote a State Department official, the worst enemy the world has. And so at this point, Khun Sa and Wei, his half-Wa protege, are just totally kicking ass and making a lot of money and controlling much of the Thai-Burma border. Now you have the CIA and the DEA are mostly on the same side, okay? The DEA wants to stop this guy for obvious reasons. The CIA does not have a connection with him or a relationship with him, not one that I was able to find, and they see him as sort of a menace on a border with a U.S. ally, a.k.a. Thailand. Now they are they're on the same team. Do they always get along? No. There's that culture clash, but the end goal is the same. They would like to stop Khun Sa. Independently of this, as we check in on what's happening in actual Wa country, the communist won, okay? The communists came over and they dominated Wa State for, nearly 20 years, 17 years or something like that. Check my math. Salu is run out. Any anti-communist Wa has had to flee. And in Wa State, it's gone communist. But they, the Wa, and interestingly, this is like right about the time the Berlin Wall goes down, and in Eastern Europe, you start to see communism crumble there. The Wa of their own volition say, we're sick of this. Mm-hmm. Hardcore Maoism is not the way to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were poor before and now we're really poor. Mm-hmm. It's just not working out. Mm-hmm. China over here is also developing more of a market economy. And so hardcore Mao is dead, by the way. We're in the late 80s. Mm. Hardcore Maoism and even Beijing is like, that's not the way to go either. And so in the spirit of the times, the Hua people overthrow the communists and they start what we now call Hua State. And that was in 1989 in April. So they're starting up what is essentially their own country or a proto country. And they go to the Chinese and say, we don't want to be a problem with you. Can we trade? The Chinese say, okay. They go to the Burmese junta and they say, we don't want any problems, but here's the deal. You're not coming in and out whenever you want. We'll say that we're part of Burma, fine. But we run the show up here. We don't want any problems. Can we all get along? And the Burmese junta says, sounds good. I think because no one really wants to pick a fight with the Hua. So we got other problems. Sure, go for it. I think the main thing is they didn't want the Hua to say, this is Hua land. We're going to the UN and we want our flag on the wall.
Yeah.
So to put a bow on it, the Hua need money. They're starting a new nation, right? And the only way to make money that they've ever seen is by producing opium and heroin. So they become sort of a mini cartel in the beginning too. And now they're starting to produce as rivals of Khun Sa, who's down on the Thai-Burma border. And how Saw Lu fits back into this, the leadership at the time fishes him out of obscurity. And they say, you know, you used to be a big deal around these parts. Mm-hmm. We're sick of communism. We know that you were anti-communist back in the day. Would you like to be a part of this nation-building project? So that's where we are in circa 1990.
Fascinating stuff. Just fascinating. So you're, this is such a transition period, not just globally, but certainly in Myanmar. And looking at, if we go back and look at what was happening with the Burmese state at the time, and obviously 1988, post-1990 elections, and with the new regime now in place, this is where you really, this crony capitalism and mm-hmm. natural resource extraction, everything else really starts to kick off. So the level of corruption and malfeasance on so many levels is kicking into high gear just nationwide, right when the Hua are also proclaiming their own independence by not waving their flags, but by virtually being independent and yet not making a big fuss about their independence, which allows them paradoxically to keep it as the heroin opium starts to go into high gear as well. And Sa Lu comes back being a very much anti-heroin, but yet is invited back into Hua State. And we have a number of other Hua actors that are also starting to take place there, as well as Khun Sa, which, as you say, seems to be disliked by many people at that time, and yet still manages to retain power for many years to come. Mm. And so then take us back into that progression and what starts to happen in this very volatile cocktail that we're building up.
What begins, and this I think is really the most fascinating part of the book, what begins is sort of a battle for the soul of this emerging Hua nation.
Mm.
So a big part of Saw Lu's original dream has been fulfilled. The Hua people are united. Wow, they've got borders now. They've even got a nascent army.
Mm.
So what type of nation is this going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mentioned before Khun Sa's Wonder Boy, Wei. He has had a falling out with Khun Sa, which is a long dramatic story. But long story short, he goes up to the Hua nation and says, I'm half Hua. I grew up around here. I think you need me. I think you need me as your financier.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll focus on Wei, but he had two brothers too who were very a big part of this as well. So they kind of came as a team and they said, you guys have been living in a communist dystopia for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, I was running essentially, I'm sort of imagining how he saw it,
mm-hmm.
a multi-million-dollar business under Khun Sa that had links all around the world. I mean, he really was a big part of that, and that's exactly what the emerging Hwa state needed. So the Hwa leadership, this is two guys. One is named Zhao Nilai, another name is Bao Yuxiang. Bao Yuxiang, Bao is the current head of state of Hwa state, still around. He's quite old, but these two guys are kind of running the show. They're the ones who threw out the commies. And they take on Wei as a, you know, it sounds good. We do need money. We're desperate for money. At the same time, Saul Lu is in the picture, and he's saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Absolutely not. We need to be a pure nation. We need to be a nation of morals. If you start going down the drug trafficking route, you're going to end up like Khun Sa, aka the worst enemy the world has, according to the United States. And it's just going to lead to our ruin. We'll always be pariahs. Saul Lu, being raised by an American missionary sect, he says, yeah, we need relationships with Burma, which I can help with. Relationships with China, that's great. Let's keep things. We need a relationship with the United States as well. Because the United States, in his eyes, is a moral Christian nation that helps the little guy. And we're the little guy. And let's begin this project of reforming our image. And so the leaders of Hwa State have Saul Lu on one shoulder and Wei on the other, and they aren't sure exactly which direction to take the country.
It's so fascinating, that that dynamic that you're painting there, because on one hand you have Wei, who's saying that, look, we have this natural resource at our disposal. I know how to run it. We can be independent. This, whatever we think about the moral, or if we think at all about the moral underpinnings of what it is that we're doing here, it is a way to our, and use that word again, our quote unquote civilization. It is a way for our protection, our independence, our security, everything else. Maybe we can transition out of that at another point. Maybe, you know, leave that for the future to talk about. Maybe we don't need to, but at least this is what we have at our disposal in order to achieve our ends. And as we're saying this, I realize so much of this conversation is about what are the means and what are the ends and what are the accommodations that we're willing to accept to get there. That's, I think that's a kind of moral relativism that we're seeing from all these different points of view. And the other side, you have Saul Lu, who's saying, no, this is going to lead to ruin eventually. Let's operate with eyes wide open. Let's not fool ourselves. Let's build this the right way so that we don't, we're not, you know, building castles on sand that we know we're just going to get wiped down eventually as we see the sweep of history. And, I think at some point you're saying that Saul Lu is even, looking at a kind of Marshall Plan for Hwa State from the United States, seeing that, hoping that he can get some kind of support to be able to, you know, build and develop, again, civilization, build and develop the right way.
That's pretty much correct. Saul Lu, you know, when I met him over our many meetings, at one point he tells me that he used to be a DEA asset. And I say, okay. You know, Saul Lu told me a lot of things, and then I had to go then track down people who could confirm if it was true or not. And I found ultimately that, other than maybe not remembering a few things right, that a lot of his stories, even his more astounding stories, turned out to be true. This is one of them. So he's like, oh, I worked with this guy. His name is Bruce. And I managed to track down Bruce. But Bruce is not with us anymore. He's passed away. And I keep tracking and tracking. And finally, I find Saul Lu's handler in the DEA. And I describe him. And he goes, oh, superstar. And I say, huh? He's like, ah, that's what we called him. That was his code name, superstar. So to rewind a little bit, Saul Lu, with the approval of the leadership of Hwa State, which is essentially a one-party state. I mean, it's not a Jeffersonian democracy, okay? The one-party, pretty militarized state and a budding drug cartel, says, can I go to the DEA and start talking to them and offer information about the drug trade writ large, and including some of our stuff, and see if they'll give us some sort of concession for it? And they say, sure, go ahead. Well, I think there were more misgivings than that, but they said, okay, Saul Lu, let's see. If you can get the United States to offer us some money, a Marshall Plan, as you put it, but, you know, the U.S. comes in and brings schools, finances roads, hospitals and the whole thing. If you can get them to do that, that's great. Until then, we're going to continue producing heroin. So Saul Liu makes contact with the DEA agents in Yangon, Rangoon as it was called at the time, and starts giving them stuff, and they're like, they think they've hit the jackpot. And so, again, this very charismatic guy, they fall under his spell, and once they're kind of hooked on all the incredible inside information he's giving them, that's when Saul Liu rolls out, like, let's level up. Astonishingly, he convinces the DEA, not just the agents in Yangon, but they go to their superiors in DC, and they're like, I think we've got a really great alternative way to fight the war on drugs here. Mm-hmm. There's this big bad drug cartel, the WA. People are still thinking they're headhunters at this point, right? Mm-hmm. I know they seem out there, but what if we co-opt them? We have them wind down their drug trade, and we bring in American aid. They wanted to do it through the UN, but minor detail. And we sort of deliver Saul Liu's vision. Now we're going to have them just burn heaps, not just heroin, but the poppy fields themselves raise into the ground. It's not coming out of the ground anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You're one of the most bountiful poppy growing areas in the world.
Wow.
And the DEA signs on. Mm. But they become very, very, very interested. And, well, we know that's not what happened, right? WA State is still a pariah, so the plan didn't work out. But that was always Saul Liu's dream.
Mm. That doesn't seem too dissimilar from the proposition that Khun Sa made the United States.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he just, he was always viewed with intense skepticism, of course, by the DEA, but by the CIA as well. And that skepticism around Khun Sa increased when he started trying to not just, hey, I'll burn all of my crops if you give me X million dollars, when he starts becoming really antagonistic. At this point, Khun Sa is saying to reporters on mainstream TV networks, to a U.S. audience, you have a nuclear weapon. George H.W. Bush was the president at the time. Mm-hmm. You have a nuclear weapon, Mr. Bush, but I have a button too, the opium button, and I can press it whenever I want, meaning I can dial up the amount of heroin that hits your streets. So, I mean, once you're talking like that, you're too far gone, and the DEA, CIA, and the American establishment in total did not like him being on that border. Saul Liu comes in, and he's a good Christian Baptist guy who's tough as nails, and there isn't all this bad blood with the WA. In fact, if you wanted to dial back to the early parts of the Cold War, the CIA was interested in co-opting them then, so maybe get that started again. And, you know, the WA occupy a lot of vast territory on the border with China. Wouldn't it be nice to have a U.S. client state or satellite there? I mean, it's a more appealing proposition.
It is, and it's, you're setting up a lot of dynamics that it would really make a lot of sense for the Americans to want to have more influence, more connection, more friends. And also lessen their own threats, to be able to minimize some of the dangers that they see there. So it's an obvious question, why didn't it happen?
Oh, for a number of reasons. The DEA was super gung-ho about this. Super gung-ho about essentially, you know, creating this drug-free U.S. satellite on the China border. That is not something the DEA should be doing, according to the CIA. I think a lot of it was actually personal. Guys, you don't go around the world making U.S. satellites. We might. That's not your job. You're supposed to fight drugs. What are you doing making funny backroom deals with a drug cartel anyway? Point two is that the CIA just didn't buy it, and they didn't trust the WA, and they thought this was kind of a zany idea. They already... In all this is happening in the U.S. Embassy in Yangon, they already were feuding the DEA and CIA for reasons I've explained before. Another really major reason has a bit of nuance to it. So if you want to go and bring civilization, to use Saul Liu's word, but no, you want to bring schools, hospitals, clinics, and American greatness to Wa State, you know, you can't just teleport into Wa State. This would have been something that you needed to cooperate with the Burmese regime in doing. Mm-hmm. You know, the Burmese regime, when the DEA wanted to go visit Wa State, which they did quite a few times, it was on a Burmese regime helicopter that they went in. Whenever the DEA, when this project got pretty far along, they had to go to the Burmese regime and say, would this be okay with you? This is happening in your country. In general, the DEA tries not to defy the host country, because the way the DEA works is they rely on their cops, their troops, to make arrests, to seize the drugs. The DEA is kind of just in the background supporting it. So this would have involved the Burmese regime being a part of the project. They would need a little taste of the donor money as well, and the aid, of course. And it would have been a total rehabilitation of their image.
Yeah, yeah.
The big bad Burmese regime, hey, actually, you know what? Maybe they're not so bad. They're actually participating with the DEA and taking down a drug cartel.
Right.
Isn't that nice? Wow, what could happen next? Maybe they'll actually go after Khun Sa. Hey, you know what? Maybe they're our buddies now. This was the history going in that direction was anathema to what the CIA wanted. They were trying to whittle down the Burmese regime, and so was much of Congress. So the CIA was against this plan. And what ensues involves wiretapping DEA agents' homes in Yangon. This is against the U.S. Constitution.
The CIA is wiretapping this.
They're wiretapping their own, you know, federal employees' homes. The CIA can wiretap foreigners' homes. You're not supposed to wiretap an American's house, a citizen, and a U.S. citizen's house. That goes beyond the remit. Some of this stuff made it to court, and if I remember correctly, some of the rationale was, well, it was an American's home, but it was in another country. That's a loophole, right? So there was a whole lawsuit full of these accusations filed by a DEA agent, and so I drew a lot from that, from the book. Ultimately, the CIA found a way to sabotage this project before it could get off the ground. How does that affect our main man, Saul Liu? Well, he looked like a clown, basically. I mean, at one point, Saul Liu had gathered the heads of Wa State and all the great men and women of Wa State on a mountain top, and the DEA was supposed to fly in and provide the original seed money to get this project going. He'd put up bunting and he'd put up a signpost, and it was meant to be a great day. The fusing of the Wa and the U.S. civilizations. You're hearing some of Saul Liu's grand, grandiose descriptions filter into my language, because that's just how he thought and how he talked.
Yeah.
In epic terms. So they're waiting on the mountain, and they're waiting on the mountain, and they're waiting on the mountain, and no one comes. And because the CIA has made sure that this thing is killed in its cradle. And Saul Liu has to go to the leaders, which is Zhao Nilai and Bao Yuxiang, and say, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. Mm. They're upset because he's made them look like fools. And Saul Liu's image really deteriorated after that. Because of the CIA. So they hurt him pretty bad.
So we see today what Wa State has become with its military, with its connection to China, with its being a narco state, as you describe in the book. We see all of that. So the question then comes, and looking at this missed opportunity, do you think that looking back at it from where we sit today, from that vantage point, do you think that an epic possibility was missed that could have redirected the trajectory of history in the region? Or do you think that this was always something of a pipe dream of a charismatic Saul Liu that really didn't have any chance of progressing the way that he envisioned it in his mind?
That's such a good question. I'm going to answer it two ways. One with my heart and one with my head. My heart says, wow, what, as somebody who's been critical of the violent nature of the war on drugs, my heart says, wow, what an incredibly ingenious way. If your goal is to stop production of drugs, go in and befriend these people who, they're not, I mean, they're not just a drug cartel. Cartel is part of their government. But these, this is a people who have a, an agenda to have their own independent, call it a country if you like, I do, that's free from the persecution from anybody, including the Burmese regime. And, you know, drugs are just a means to get there. Well, why don't you, you know, zoom the elevator to the top floor and get them there, and they can give up the drugs. It just was so clever, I thought. And so, you know, you have to mourn that possibility. I don't know exactly how it would have turned out. My head says, China and Chinese intelligence are extremely clever, and they really care about that border. And they are simply better at managing that border and Hua people in general than the United States ever will. And so the creation of a pro-U.S. Hua state on China's back door, I don't know what that would have led to. Probably nothing good. China, and I think, frankly, any great power is not going to tolerate something like that. So eventually, it probably would have crumbled for that reason. So those are my two answers. I guess the second one is my real answer.
Right. Well, we only know what actually happened, and what happened was the development of a narco state with a very formidable army, military, with closer relations with China. And so that's where I'd like you to lead us today, is to looking at where we know this history then went, where it led us to today, and looking at what then happened with the development of the Hua state, of Hua leadership, of their relations with China, of how powerful their military was to become, and how much of a player they are in the region, and then what we also know of the dynamics of this internal state within a state, or maybe just a country itself.
Yeah, we'll fast forward to the modern day. So now, principally, the narcotics that are produced in Hua State are methamphetamine and, to a degree, ketamine. These are synthetics. Is actually, I think I give a lot of credit to Wei Sukang and his brothers for overseeing the transition to synthetics, which is the future of narcotics. You don't have to grow some plants out of the ground and oversee a peasant army of opium poppy growers. You mix some chemicals in a lab, and that's your product. So that is still a key part of the Hua economy. Things work a little differently today, though. The Hua on the narcotics side have a more sophisticated operation where they will provide land, usually to a Chinese syndicate that wants to come in and build the meth lab, and they will tax it. Any government eventually wants to get to this point. Let commerce play out and you take a tax. Hua senior officers don't want to be in the drug lab mixing things up. They don't care about that. Give us 10%, give us 20%, whatever. And that's where the profit comes from. So that's how it works now. The degree to, like, how much of the Hua GDP comes from narcotics versus mining, which they also have a big operation in, I have no idea. I don't know that they know.
What is it they mine?
So tin, T-I-N. Although I have heard that some of the supplies of that have run out. I mean, at one point, tin was going from Hua State into the Chinese market and then going into, like, people's gadgets. So you have this narco state that its leadership is wanted by the DEA, also supplying materials that might go into your Samsung phone, right? Nothing against Samsung. I don't know that. I've just pulled an example out. I'm sure Samsung phones don't have bad stuff in them. Anyway. Don't want to get sued. And now increasingly rare earths. So that's, I think, an emerging profit center for the Hua. The narcotics are still there, too. I mean, they I skipped this part. Eventually, they conquered Kunsa's territory. Mm-hmm. So now they control all that border with Burma and Thailand, and that Kunsa used to control. So again, it's all real estate. You need a place to produce narcotics, and you need a border to put them into the country that can either consume them or has ocean access that you can ship them abroad. So it's kind of a hands-off landlord model. Somebody else comes in and we tax it. Politically speaking, I think I said in the last pages of my book, I'm not sure what Myanmar's regime will look like in 5 years, whether it will have crumbled, but I think Wa State will be around for another 50 years. I still feel that way. Wa State is a client state of China. It runs on Chinese business. It runs on Chinese infrastructure. The mobile phone towers in Wa State come from China. The medical expertise comes from China. The highways, they have these pretty impressive roads, actually, through Wa State, overseen by Chinese engineers. So China has really invested a lot in Wa State. They're not even shy about it. When Wa State has big celebrations, senior diplomats appointed by Xi Jinping will be sitting beside the leader of Wa State, Bao Yuxiang. So it's a Chinese satellite. What you're going to see increasingly, I predict, is that Wa independent spirit and that Wa independent streak becoming more and more uncomfortable with that. China has them over a barrel and can dictate terms to them. But there are, trust me, a lot of Wa people who are uncomfortable with that and just don't like that state of affairs. What they can do about it, I don't know, because they're next to a rising power. But by and large, if Wa State is, I'll put it even more plainly, I know through sources I have that before any Wa leader does anything, they think, is this going to annoy Beijing? They run that as a filter through their head for their own survival. So that's the status quo now. And probably is a recipe for continued stability, more so than the regime in Naypyidaw. But, the Chinese really have a lot of leverage over them.
And yet the Wa are not without their own armed forces. And it's, as we've mentioned, it's a very formidable military. And so what can you tell us about the development of that military? Because this is, again, I mean, and we widen out the scope and look at the Burma scene. I mean, what's been remarked upon by several analysts out there, it's quite interesting, is that the two of the most impressive and formidable ethnic militaries in Myanmar did not exist in any form, a decade or two ago. Of course, AA being the other one. Mm-hmm. This is, just the nature of the rise and fall of all the different ethnic militias that are out there and the complexity in trying to track them. But certainly when you look at the Wa military, just in terms of how strong it is and how it really came from nowhere to develop what it is, and that is a feature of security, that they do have their own military that can be used. What can you tell us about how that was developed, how strong it is, as well as whatever you know about the arms production that's able to be maintained locally?
Yeah, they have 30,000 troops and I think 20,000 reservists. As I commented in my book, that's a army on par with, if you're just looking at manpower, Sweden, Kenya. Okay, this is not a joke.
Yeah.
They have pretty high-end military hardware that has somehow it happens to be exactly what the PLA uses, the People's Liberation Army of China. Mm-hmm. I wonder why. Mm-hmm. So clearly they are armed by China. We're talking shoulder-fired missiles that could potentially take out a fighter jet, stuff that other groups like the Karen, the Kachin would can only dream of. They would love to have this stuff. Armored carriers, armed drones. I mean, they love to parade their military hardware so that everybody can see how powerful the Wa are. It's not a mistake that they've had a reliable stream of income, I think largely from narcotics, and they are able to sustain such a large army. Armies like that are not cheap. Yeah. Their army's big, their army's tough, no one wants to mess with them. They also produce their own rifles. I think it's called the Wa-81. It's a copy of a Chinese assault rifle. If, like me, anybody likes to go on social media and see all of the battles filmed by ethnic armed groups and PDFs, you'll often see them holding one of these Wa guns in their hand.
Yeah.
It'll be a mishmash of guns, stuff they've stolen from the junta and stuff they rigged themselves, but a Wa rifle will often be in the video. The Wa, again, coming back to the start of the conversation, they see the Revolutionary War as something that lowlanders are going to have to hash out. But they are more active players than they may seem.
Yeah.
They're not going to get involved, but they have provided support to the Arakan army. They provided a lot of support to the TNLA, the Ta'ang, a lot to the Kokang, and a group that's colloquially called the Mungla Army to their south. I forget the acronym. Is it NDAA? Anyway. They formed these like buffer states around them. Mm-hmm. What any, you know, rising country wants to do is have influence over all the other groups. So if the Myanmar military were to ever come towards them in the mountains, they have like three or four groups that they support surrounding them. They've supplied money, they've supplied weapons, probably intelligence as well. So they're in pretty good shape. However, within the past week, there's been a really negative development from the Wa standpoint. China, which seems to be placing more of its bets on the regime moving forward, especially as we get closer to an election in December, came in and used its leverage on the Wa like in a way that the Wa really, really, really did not want to see coming. And they said, quit supporting all of these other groups.
Oh.
You know, the Kokang came down from their mountain stronghold and they took over an entire city, Lashio. Much of the reporting for my book actually takes place in Lashio, because that's where I met Saul Lu.
Mm.
They took over this entire city
and
were holding it. I think it's one of the most impressive gains from anti-junta forces of this entire war.
Yeah.
And the Chinese said, nope, you're going to give back that city. And you, the Wa, who are acting as sort of the big brother, big daddy to these other groups, cut it out. Stay in your lane. So that just happened. And so when I say there could be a pushback among the Wa, wow, you know, we worked really hard with our blood, sweat, and tears to create, you know, this system where we're like sort of the sun at the center of the solar system in northern Myanmar. That's getting eroded by China. So,
wow, that's a lot to take in.
Yeah,
it answers the question that was on the tip of my tongue the whole time you're talking, which is, how in the world are the Wa continuing to support and provide weapons, funds, other things to all of these other groups when simultaneously we see Beijing that is wanting to, as you say, placing more of their bets on the junta. But that answers the question that obviously Beijing is not happy about that. And that is also such monumental news, because if these resistance forces are getting so much of their support from Wa in their battles, which they're largely winning in overwhelming fashion, except when airstrikes come in against the Burmese military, then if they start to be cut off, how will that impact the trajectory of the fighting that happens? And when the election comes in, it, we know that the Burmese military is wanting to control as much ground as they can prior to the election. They don't care if people are actually living in those territories. They don't care if they have to push people to the ballot box in December with a rifle in their back to be able to make the vote. They just want to simply be able to say that we have more percentage of territories that we've gained to be able to show that their election is more legitimate, even though we all know what the result is going to be.
Sure.
But if those resistance forces are then getting less support in these ongoing battles, then we see how that's all playing out with the election moving.
Well, you know, you fight your ass off and you take over an entire city, Lazio is not just some city, by the way. It's home to Northeastern Military Command. This is the junta's main outpost in that part of Myanmar. And they come in and they take over. And, I mean, you can't imagine, a bigger victory than taking over an entire city. But if China can come in and say, then flip the chessboard and say no, then, look, I think this is one of the most deleterious things that's happened for the resistance in total since the Revolutionary War began. And I worry that other analysts, I mean, look, I'm not an expert on anything, okay? I'm just a guy who's a journalist who's really interested in WA state, okay? But I worry that other analysts miss it because the WA don't really talk to the international press. I get this stuff from WA friends, and it's out there. All the exile press has covered this. But they're not as engaged with, say, exile media, and certainly not English language press is what I really mean, the way that the Karen are, the Kachin are. So I would just say, really keep your eyes on this if you want to see how this is going. I'm feeling a little despondent about it, if I'm trying to think from the perspective of the resistance. It's a heavy blow. But never make predictions about Myanmar, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Have you then followed the thread of this story, and have you spoken to anyone in the resistance, Karen, Kachin, PDFs, about the implications that they see of this supply of support and weapons they've been getting possibly being cut off?
I have not, because it really just happened like days ago. What I predict, what did I just say? Don't predict about Myanmar. What I worry about is before you had this Northern Alliance, the Ta'ang, the Kokang, and other groups really taking over a lot of territory in that northern part of Myanmar and holding it and being very formidable. So if they're fractured, then the junta can come in and focus on getting all these places back. And if they think that China has their back, then they can secure as much territory as they need to and really fight for it and hold it. And then they'll turn their attention to the other groups. This is, if you look at the military history of Burma and the resistance history, it's all about sort of like settling things in one part of the country and then going full bore in another. Yeah. So when one area gets locked up and you becomes weary, and even, you know, these groups like the Ta'ang and the Kokang, they may be more inclined to make those peace deals than, say, the Karen would. Mm-hmm. And so if that happens, then the junta can say, okay, northern Myanmar, quiet for now. Let's send all of our troops to, Arcon. Let's send all of our troops to Karen. Let's really drill down on some of the other groups. So nothing ever happens in a vacuum.
Right. And then looking at this aspect of, you started the story of how the drug trade started, the narcotics flow began, and then how that then shifted. The opium and heroin shifted to meth, which we're seeing more recently, as well as the way of production, that it's not so much the WA state producing it, it's more independently produced but then taxed. Can you give us a sense of both the scale of what we're seeing from those narcotics, and again, which kind as well that we're seeing post-coup, as well as where it's ending up and where it's going?
Yeah. There is a notion out there that I've seen in a lot of articles that says since the coup happened, drug production has skyrocketed. I am a skeptic of that theory because the places where drugs are produced are either places like WA State, which they totally control, the junta has no control over it, or you have these smaller sort of like family-run armed clans that in Burmese are called P2SIT, that are allied with the junta, and they do some drug production as well. These are just, I don't think the coup changed the landscape of like where drugs are produced. I think it's just going up because of market forces. I have a more boring theory, I suppose, that as Southeast Asia writ large, just there's more disposable income going around, more drugs will be required to meet that demand. So primarily we're talking about crystal methamphetamine and Yaba, which I think many of your listeners will be familiar with, but if you're not, it's a little pink pill that you can swallow or smoke that contains meth and caffeine. We're seeing, you can track the stuff by looking at the prices, and the prices have gotten pretty low. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if we've reached a saturation point, mm-hmm. if this is about the level of meth that the market wants. Either way, it's huge. I mean, certainly Yaba pills, these meth pills, billions are produced. And if you look at Southeast Asia in total, again, with Myanmar being kind of the center of that, the UN estimates somewhere between $30 and $60 billion worth of a drug economy. The fact that it's between 30 and 60 billion shows they don't really know. Yeah. These are with, just be skeptical of numbers that you hear. It's huge. It's really, really huge. And more evidence for this is just, you look at a group like the United Wa State Army and just how solvent they are compared to groups, I think, like the KNU, which I don't believe are involved in drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. And they're tough fighters, but they're on fighting on shoestrings, right? The just look at the health and the quality and the formidability of the WA, and I think you can see what drug profits buy. Let me just also add to that. The average WA person, including the average WA soldier, is not in a cartel. Many of them have never seen drugs, couldn't afford them. Again, this is happening with outside syndicates coming in, building a meth lab somewhere in the territory, and it gets trucked to Thailand. If you see a photo of a WA soldier, male or female, don't say, oh, look, a narco soldier. They don't have anything to do with this stuff.
Yeah.
If you see a soldier in the Saudi Arabian army, don't, oh, he must be an oil baron. No. This is something that happens away from their, for the most part, away from the average grunt's eyes.
Right. Let's return back to some of these three main characters that we talked about in the WA community. Yeah. We have Sa Lu, have Bao, and Wei. And update where those three are at, what they're doing today, as well as at least in the case of Wei, as you go into in the book, just the real international scrutiny and attention that he drew.
Yeah, I guess I'll start with Wei. Wei was in position to be the next Khun Sa, meaning the big bad guy that the DEA put posters up everywhere and sort of fermented anger in the American public. We're going to get this guy. And there were some attempts to do that. Wei, just in general, is really good at keeping his mouth shut. He's not a loud mouth. He is... he's a quiet, intelligent operator. I heard stories about like people taking his photo and him being like, break the camera, basically. Like, he does not allow people to take his photo or see what he looks like now. From what I was able to gather, he's in his probably late 70s now and in a stage of semi-retirement. The DEA never caught him. He has basically rode his drug empire into the sunset, and now I believe that people under him have learned all of his tricks and are running it on their own. I don't know this for sure, but I don't think he's the one picking up the phone and running logistics anymore. I think he's aged past that. I could be wrong, but I think he's mostly retired. Bao is also up in years. Also wanted by the DEA, never caught him. He is officially he is the head of WA State. At this point, I think it's safe to say that the WA have managed something very difficult, and that is sort of a secession, so that his sons and other relatives are now running the show in a dynastic fashion. If you look at the like the hierarchy of who controls Wa State, there's a lot of people with the last name Bao. So it's his sons, their Baos, you got Bao cousins, you got Bao nephews. It's a bit of a family dynasty type thing. I don't know. He looks pretty creaky on his feet, so I don't know if he'll be around a lot longer. But safe to say, the government of Wa State is in his family's hands, and they'll move it forward. Okay. Saul Lu. Spoiler alert, if you're halfway through the book, Saul Lu, unfortunately, is no longer with us. He died from COVID. So anyone following news in Myanmar remembers that really nasty wave of COVID, I think in 2021, where the coup had happened. Services were awful. Hospitals were overwhelmed. People were afraid to go to the hospital. And a lot of people, especially older folks in Myanmar, started passing away from COVID. He passed away, and I continue to be really close with his family still. I keep in very close touch with them. I think they'll always be a part of my life. And, you know, I've been asked by people who've read the book, like, oh, would you call yourself, like, friends with Saul Lu? Were you an admirer of his? And I would say that about certain members of his family. I can't think of anyone I've ever met who I'm more different than. I mean, he is like made of granite. This guy survived torture, went into battle seemingly fearlessly, made all of these giant risky leaps in his life and often really suffered for it, and never ever questioned whether he was doing the right thing. Believed he was sent by God to be an agent for goodness on this earth. And just about everything I said is the opposite of how I am. I question, you know, did I put the right pair of shoes on today? And I'm not made of granite, let's say that. So I was drawn to him because we're so different. And, you know, I'm not sure I'll ever meet another person that interesting till the day I die.
Wow. I'm also interested in the trajectory of Wa State itself, because places are not monolithic. And we can talk about the elites that are in power and the decisions that have been made and where that lands it and the Chinese relations and everything else. But, you know, as we saw with some of the tensions and battles that were playing out in terms of what the nascent Wa State and their identity and what they would become, you know, I'm wondering about the fissures and the tensions within Wa itself, of those who, and the political system itself and the economic system. Are there the freedoms that are granted? Are there minorities? Are there younger generations that are looking to the West or looking for greater aspirations of what they want their state to become? Or that are there anti-Chinese sentiments? Are there those whose opportunities are being denied or unhappy with what I would assume would be some sort of military conscription that would be having to join those ranks? What are the tensions that you see playing out that could impact the future of Wa State as well?
Economically speaking, I think the problem is there's no middle class. There's a agricultural class. I mean, people literally just farming what's in their backyard. And again, the land is really quite bad. And that's a large number of Wa people. Their health, if they need to get health care, it's not very good. Schooling is not great.
Right.
It's what Saul Lu wanted to fix, right?
Yeah.
Then you have the elites who are in the United Wa State Army. It's basically a militarized state. The people that sort of sit up on top. At the very, very top, you have people whose last name is Bao, and they're really running the show. But then in the middle, you have just a lot of military, senior military officers, and their word is golden. If they tell you to do something, you do it. And then you have Chinese businessmen and women who come in and kind of keep the economy going. They're frankly just better as a mercantile class at propping up the Y economy. Just like in the middle, there's not much.
Yeah.
One way to secure your basic standard of living is to join the WA State Army, the United WA State Army. And many, well, every family has to give up at least one son. But I've seen a lot of women join as well, young women. And that means you will get better medical care, you'll have three meals a day, and you'll have something to do. And then when you're in the army, then you can then make connections because the path to any type of prosperity is through the army. I mean, they run the show. So that's what I worry about economically. There's just, you know, not enough of a middle class. Culturally, you know, WA State is seen as this like black spot on the map. You can't peer into. If you get this Chinese app, I don't speak Chinese, but I think it's pronounced Douyin. It's Chinese TikTok. You can peer in all day long. All those young soldiers are on Chinese, let's call it Chinese TikTok, all day long, doing their little dances, playing the guitar and like crooning at the camera and doing things that are remarkably similar to what teenagers and young people do in every other country. So, you know, every time that I interface with WA people through friends or even by just looking at this app, I'm just struck by how normal they are. I'll say this. There are more opportunities in WA State because of the Chinese economic influence than there are in most, I would say, most other parts of Myanmar right now. Especially if you're in the backwoods of Sagaing State and the military PDF fighting is like really vicious and everyone's just really hanging on trying to survive. You would much rather be in WA State, and in fact, people will pay pretty good money to get smuggled into WA State to do construction.
Wow.
You'll have a guy from Arakan pay to get there. Mm-hmm. You'll have people from Shan State pay to get there.
Wow.
I think you mentioned something about minorities. Religious minorities are tolerated to an extent. Minorities from other parts of Myanmar are, I think, tolerated perfectly fine. Everyone knows it's WA State and WA run the show. Mm-hmm. Some Christian groups, especially those influenced by the West, I think started to gather a little too much influence and got knocked back down. But you can go to church there, and it's fine. It's not a big deal. So it's hardly utopian. I think life there for most WA people is pretty difficult, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that more profits from whether it's mining or narcotics made its way back into a social safety net.
Yeah.
I actually think that about almost every country on earth. So there you go.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, it has that stability and it has a greater stability. It also has a greater economic force, obviously greater security with the military. But I was curious to what degree that was uplifting the overall people, because that is a marker for its continued trajectory. You know, ultimately, if you do have the stratification and this separation between the classes, and more elites that are operating at their level, then they start to see the people as the enemy. And then that becomes a process of tearing it apart. But the more that the overall people can be uplifted by that, then they're all kind of in it together. And it seems like you have a more of a genuine stability going forward.
Yeah, there's not enough of that. Mm. A lot of people, most WA people now speak Chinese.
Mm.
And I think you have a lot of people who are wanting to go over the border in China and find work there. Too. I mean, they kind of see that as a better way out, which is sad because it would be great if their own homeland could be further developed. I don't have a window into the WA financial statement, so I don't know if this is the best they can do. Maybe the narcotics aren't bringing as much money in as I thought, and the military is their first priority, and they focus on that, and there's not money left over.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to imagine that some of it is just squandered in crypto accounts.
Yeah.
And very popular there is the use of the cryptocurrency Tether. It's pegged to the US dollar. So a lot of assets are held in that, and a lot of things are exchanged in that. And then additionally, they use Chinese yuan as well. But yeah, I think a lot of people try to make it to China. Just as an aside, I said that the China came in and laid down the law to the Hua leaders and said, you're not going to provide support to any of these other armed groups. What they did, they didn't just say that. Before they did that, they freezed a lot of important people's bank accounts in China. And wow. Then they made border trade down to a trickle. Mm. So you had even Hua farmers who couldn't get the basics that they needed to get by. And, you know, they basically made the economy scream. So when the Hua summoned all of their allies to a meeting, they were apologetic. They said, we can't tolerate this anymore. So the supply of aid and training and everything that we were giving you cuts off completely now because we've been forced into this situation. Speculating here, a more compliant and a more compliant Hua leadership might not have said that publicly, but they let them know China's, look what China's doing to us. So they were willing to kind of put what China did out in the open and let everybody know.
Right. Yeah. Now we keep talking about how strong this military is, but have they, have there been any skirmishes, any battles they've been involved in any recent years?
That is the dirty secret of the Hua that I don't think they like people to bring up. Mm. No. Mm. Skirmishes, yes. Mm. And they had a pretty significant war with Shan State Army South some 20 years ago, if I remember the dates right. That's a militia started by a former acolyte of Kun Sa that controls part of the Thai-Burma border. They squabbled with them for territory recently. No. And so a lot of those 30,000 troops, you might find them doing other things, laying bricks, tending to that highway, working in the garden behind the commander's house, kind of just keeping the state. I mean, they're kind of the civil service too. We don't know what it would look like if they were suddenly forced to wage a battle. So no, the Karen, the Kachin, the Taang, the Kokang have much more fresh battlefield experience. You know, to the Waz, maybe they would say, hey, look, no one's picked a fight with us. But they work very hard, they work overtime to make themselves look formidable. And I guess it works, maybe too well.
So we've talked about the current relations of the Hua with the Chinese and then with the PDF, some of the ethnic organizations. How about with the current incarnation of the Burmese military, Min Aung Hlaing? Have there been meetings? Have there been diplomatic relations? What connections can you tell us about that?
They stay in touch, and when the junta calls a meeting, Hua representatives will show up. It's not antagonistic, but it's not warm either. That's been the truth since Hua State was founded. The Hua have red lines that they demand be respected, and the Burmese junta, for the most part, does not cross those red lines. I think from the junta's perspective, they see getting in a tangle with the Hua right now as an incredibly stupid idea. Yeah. They're having enough trouble beating back the Arakan army, which, as you said, didn't exist that many years ago, right? So you don't want to make an enemy of the Hua right now. Now I'm totally speculating. I would imagine that when China decided to put more of its chips on the Burmese regime and in backroom discussions, if China said, is there anything you can do? One of the first things the junta would say is like, yeah, can you get the Hua to stop propping up all of these groups, one of which took over a major city? You know, you cut that out, and that'll save us a lot of grief. So if the junta wanted to exert influence on the Hua, it would probably do so indirectly. But again, I'm just speculating. I don't know whose idea that was.
Do you have any sense of what the WA leadership actually wants out of this current battle? I mean, you mentioned how they've historically seen it as these are all just lowlanders fighting. And I think the easy answer there is just, well, we want the security of our own territory, and we want to administer this the way that we want, and we want to get rich in the process and be secure. I think that's the obvious answer. But if you were really to have an informed conversation with some of the leadership, do you think they have a sense of how they would like to see this current conflict playing out in Myanmar, and who they might like to see come out on top, and what kind of system they might like to see set up?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you asked me that a year ago, I would have a cleaner answer, and I would say that the WA, very pragmatic leadership, was trying to take advantage of the chaos. So the WA are more trusted by the junta than, say, the Ta'ang, who they hate, or other groups. And so you could see the WA kind of like pushing the limits to, could they expand their territory a little bit? And there's a town called Tangyan, which is sort of the gateway from Burma to WA state. And you had the WA coming in and saying, just to make sure everything is peaceful here, we're going to kind of deploy troops to Tangyan and hold this. So you see that the other territory got a little bit bigger. Then you had certain areas, I believe, taken by the Kokang, which are predominantly ethnic WA, but belong to the Burmese, were controlled by the Burmese junta, and they gifted it to the WA. And so the WA, when does that ever happen? When does another army take over territory and say, hey, buddy, you guys want this? So, and then even in Lashio, when the Kokang took it over, Kokang and other forces, you saw the WA put some troop emplacements there. They said just to make sure that some of our assets in town are looked after, but you could see the nibbling at the edges, like, can we push this further? Can we push this further? So I think it was just, as Littlefinger from Game of Thrones said, chaos is a ladder, and they were going to go up that ladder.
Yeah.
Now I'm imagining that it's just that their network is under attack. It's just to say, okay, geez, all right, let's just retreat and make sure that what's really important to us, which is our core territory, is not violated in any way, and just to withdraw and focus on basics. That would be my assumption.
And then just looking at WA state in the greater national scope, just first a question, just I think for some of the lay audience that's listening and trying to get a sense of the accessibility here, if you were just a tourist or a backpacker who just wanted to go and land in WA state, who is it open to? How do you get there?
What does this person look like? And I'm sorry to be so crude, but what is their race? And I would need to know that answer first. If they look like me, extremely difficult to go. You know, I was actually invited to their 30th anniversary celebration in their capital, Pangsang. And I didn't put this in the book, but was getting ready to go. And but they wanted the Burmese government to give me permission to travel through their territory to get to WA state. And the Burmese embassy here in Bangkok said, no way. So
you can't fly in.
No, there's three ways to go in. One would be fly into Myanmar and then go through an extensive network of roads to drive to WA state. Now, once you got to the WA border, they'd say, who are you? Why are you here? Who's allowing you passage? If it's someone who's getting smuggled in for work, then that smuggler would already have worked that out. If you're going in there for a political meeting, you would need to have a piece of paper or a phone number to call. Say, this guy on the Politburo wants me to come in for a meeting. If you're doing business, someone needs to set it up. The other way would be coming through China. Chinese business people come in and out all the time. Not a problem. Then they have territory along the border with Thailand. That is more closely guarded. I think more nefarious stuff is happening along that border, and so that's less of that's even less open. Mm-hmm. Although if you know people, you can go back and forth there too. And then there is another way to get in. I hope I can explain. Up the Mekong River, that you can take a boat and then get off at a river port controlled by some allies they have to their south, and hop off the boat and get on a truck or car and drive this highway all the way through Mung La up to their capital, Pangsan. Again, if you're, look, I'll just say it frankly, if you're a white guy, good luck. Yeah. They're inherently suspicious. If you are a Chinese speaker who is non-white, your chances will go up in a big, big way. So I have friends who are Chinese, obviously speak Chinese, and I tell them, please go do the research that I can't. Mm. You know, my book is not meant to be the be-all, end-all of what WA State is. It's actually really about WA State's strange relationship with my own country and its government. Mm. As far as what's happening like in WA State on a day-to-day basis now, I'm not the guy to write that book. Yeah. I'm just not. Yeah. And so I hand it over. I will gladly assist any Chinese-speaking journalist of good faith who wants to go there. There are ways. There are ways. But a backpacker with blonde dreadlocks, give it up. Find another unusual place to go.
It's not a place to go and chill and find a good hostel.
No. Might be hostile, but there's no hostel.
Right. So then updating that last remark you said about your part of what you wanted to write was about the strange relationship with your country. What is the strange relationship with your country, America, today? Is WA State even on the map? Is it even known? Is it a place of interest to the CIA or the DEA? And, you know, what... always have to have a bit of a disclaimer on this, but what thoughts do you have, if any, about where the current Trump administration might be seeing not just Myanmar, because there's been some updates about that lately, but where, if at all, WA State fits into the current calculation? And obviously, you know, we wouldn't expect Trump himself to really know. I don't know if he can pick Myanmar on a map, let alone WA State's importance within Myanmar, but are there people in the Trump orbit that may be singling out or looking at WA State as a place of interest, and if so, how?
The nature of my work is such that the people that can really open up and tell me a lot are retired. So some of my information is years out of date. Mm-hmm. People who are an active CIA officer really should not be talking to somebody like me. I mean, I would enjoy that, but I don't think that that would be... they should probably be fired.
Yeah.
That goes with active DEA. In fact, I would get a lot of trouble if they gave a recorded interview to me. So I don't have the absolute up-to-date latest information on that. What I can say is that the DEA, I think, is pretty much given up on fighting drugs coming out of WA State. Mm-hmm. I tried to get commentary about what are your goals. Look, if you look at what the DEA, the last thing that they've said is we want to dismantle the leadership of WA State, and we want much of their leadership to be in an American prison cell. Okay, well, how's that going? I mean, if you ask the DEA now, I get kind of a non-answer. Behind the scenes, somebody who does know what they're talking about has said, I don't think the current director of the DEA knows what WA State is. Mm. So I guess they've given up and it's just receded into the background. The other important thing is the drugs that are pouring out of WA State are not making it to the United States, not in any big numbers. Mm. The Asian market, Southeast Asian market, is big enough to absorb all of those narcotics. You don't have to ship it across the Pacific. So it's not really hurting American citizens. Aussies, the Australian intelligence people and anti-narcotics people, they really have their eye on WA State because some of that crystal meth is making it to Perth and Sydney. Mm. So they care a lot. I would bet that the AFP, the Australian Federal Police, know more about what's going on than the DEA right now. As far as CIA goes, I really don't know. I keep waiting for some senator to, like, I don't know, find my book and then be clicked onto this, like, wait a minute. Yeah. There's a drug-producing army on China's border that's supported by the Chinese Communist Party, and this is just a perfect smear to, like, rub in China's face, because it's true.
Yeah.
And that's not how I present my information, but you could certainly spin it like that. And I guess they have better things to read, because that hasn't happened yet. So once a Congress member or Congress gets clicked into something, then they can kind of direct intelligence there and ask them to, especially if they're on the right committee. So I don't know. It's very possible the CIA just doesn't have much on the wall right now, or it's, you know, number four in some guy's portfolio at the embassy in Bangkok, and not his main thing.
So its heyday has kind of run its course,
I guess. I mean, the influence of Law State is greater than ever, and I guess was until last week, but it's not going anywhere. It is a Chinese client state that controls vast territory on the border of Thailand, which is ostensibly a U.S. ally. There are many reasons to want to keep an eye on what they're doing, but to the degree to which they are, they're not vocal about it.
But then I guess if we're playing a game of Risk and we're imagining some interested U.S. party, the question comes, what kind of influence or relationship could you even have when it's a state within a state of the Burmese regime bordering on China? So just going back to that last question of how do you even get into Hoa State, you know, what would an imaginary theoretical Hoa American relations even look like in the geopolitical context that it's in?
If I were a CIA station chief in Bangkok, I would run it through Thailand.
Yeah.
Making direct overtures from the U.S. government to the Hoa, it's run by a Politburo. They're going to turn around and immediately tell the Ministry of State Security, which is China's like FBI and CIA rolled into one, because the fact that the overture was even made, they would be like, I didn't ask for this. Don't. We don't want problems. They would immediately tell China.
Yeah.
China might, I think China has a, knows everything that moves in Hoa State. But if you ran it through Thailand, Thailand shares this border with Hoa State, a southern enclave of Hoa State. And Thailand has reasons, I think, to have a better relationship with the Hoa. If you look at Thailand's military, particularly the what they call the Third Army, which is the branch of the military that occupies northern Thailand, they do have relationships with the Hoa guys on the other side. They maintain a border. It's not an official border, but there's a border where there's Thai troops on one side, Hoa troops on the other. So they talk, and they may talk more than we know. Why would you want to have a better relationship? Well, you want to have a smoother border. Thailand gets annoyed when the Hoa start to build encampments that they see as too close or even in Thai territory. They feuded about that recently. But my crazy idea, maybe I've spent too much time with Saul Liu, is a grand bargain, okay? Where Thailand goes to the Hoa and says, you know, a lot of narcotics produced on your territory, we're not saying by you, but somehow they end up here. We're not accusing you of anything. They end up here and we don't like it. What could we give you that would make you dial that back? And then you could open a conversation. You can't have this conversation with a cartel in Mexico because they exist for one purpose only, and that's to make money. They have no reason to reduce their profits. But the Hoa, again, their main goal is to be a nation state.
So
you say, what do you guys need? Would you like, you know, is it certain, do you mean more cement trucks going over the border so that you can accelerate construction of ABC? I don't know what they want. So if that conversation has been had, I don't know about it. And then, of course, if I was with CIA, I would then ask the Thais to debrief me on what those conversations sounded like. That would be my plan. Mm. Not pitching for a job in the CIA. I don't think they would hire me, but that's what I would do.
Mm. Well, we know we do have listeners in Congress and the intelligence services on this platform, so... You know, we'll watch the news and see if your your suggestion will trickle down anywhere.
We'll see. I want credit, okay? Yeah. I don't want any money. Just to be like, you know, that crazy Patrick Wynn guy. He had that one good idea. And seriously, in the spirit of Saulu, it's a creative solution to the war on drugs, which has been going for more than 50 years, and nobody with a straight face can say that it's working.
Yeah.
So let's try something different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is interesting. It is a, it would be a very delicate task, and a lot of things can go wrong. But looking at where American involvement could come into WA and what role it would play, it's certainly a bold move to imagine those possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's going to happen, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
just. To be clear, the Thai military does not have a very peachy view of the WA, and a lot of they're heavily influenced by the U.S., but that's probably less true now than it was even a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they can make up their own mind.
So with that, I thank you so much for joining us on this. I want to again call out your book, Narcotopia, and encourage our listeners to go and check that out and read it. There's really just this conversation could not do justice so much of the information that was in there. So if this is intriguing to listeners, I really want to suggest that you go back and read that one as well as your book before it, which our previous conversation was based on. And I think this was a very illuminating and fascinating talk going back through several decades of history into what we're seeing today and looking at the incredible significance and importance, perhaps being underappreciated and underreported, of WA State in the context of this current climate. So it's not just a fascinating story you tell of history, but also something that is incredibly relevant today to understanding the current situation.
Very illuminating conversation as well. I thought your questions really drew out some really great stuff. I'd be super grateful to anybody who's bought the book or wants to buy the book. Look, I've been an investigative journalist here in Southeast Asia for 17 years. I've wanted to write this book for more than 10 years, and I've had many false starts and many attempts. It is one of the most difficult subjects to really get access to, but it's also, I think, the most underappreciated and interesting, fascinating story in Southeast Asia today. And again, I would like to see somebody carry on this work, go even deeper, go even farther. Just please, if you've never heard of WA State, this will be a nice introduction. The book will give you an even deeper introduction. And if you have, but you think that it's just some dark, out-of-the-way place that doesn't matter, please, please update your thinking on this. There is no way to tell the story of Myanmar and where it's headed if you are leaving out the WA. It's just a giant piece of the puzzle missing, and things will confuse you and spin you around if you don't understand the role of the WA. So it's well worth looking into.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast. We hope you liked what you heard today. And if so, you might be interested to know that over the years, we've built an extensive archive that now numbers in the hundreds of episodes, all of which are freely available to anyone who wants to listen. Our latest estimate is that it contains well over 360 hours of interesting, thought-provoking, even inspiring content. That's 15 days of continuous listening for those willing to forego sleep and want to go from episode number one until the one you just heard. In other words, there's a lot there. These past interviews, they capture the stories, struggles, and triumphs of Myanmar's people, along with the insights of foreign allies and observers who've played a role in navigating these critical moments. There are also more than a few discussions covering spiritual journeys thrown in as well. Together,
Our archive forms a rich tapestry of perspectives documenting pivotal points in the country's history and offering a deeper understanding of its complexities. However, producing episodes and maintaining this archive takes a significant investment of time and resources, and we rely on the support of listeners like you to keep it accessible. If you found value in what we offer, whether through today's episode or a deep dive into our past discussions, we invite you to help us sustain this work. Your contribution allows us to maintain and continue expanding this archive, as well as producing new episodes free of charge to all. So consider making a donation at insightmyanmar.org/donation.
Ya ranang kaya unya na ada duya dana biar di ganeza de mana we kada besa ya na besa ya ho ba ya ranang da da ya ranang na ya ranang ya da ya ranang po da ba ya ranang.